सच शीशी मारे सिवाय गई से सी बात को ना तो सिवाय महाराज प्रभाद की जाए इस कान फाउंडर चाय शिल प्रभाद की जाए नंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जाए नाम चाय शिल हरिदास ठाकुर की जाए प्रेम शिखो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री द्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासरि गौर भक्ति वृंद की जाय श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गो गोपीना श्याय मुकुंद राधा कुंद गिरि गोवर्धन की जाय वृंदावन धाम की जाय मथुर धाम की जाय नवद्वीप मायापुर धाम की जाय जगन्नाथ पुरी धाम की जाय गंगमय जमुना देवी की जाय भक्ति देवी की जाय तुलसी महारानी की जाय समवेत भक्तवृंद की जाय गौर प्रेमानंदे ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल्ड डिवोटीज All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vinanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharane. Nirvasesa Sanyavadi Paskachade Satarane. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya July 5th, 2012, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 18, Maharaj Prakrit, cursed by a Brahmana boy, text 29. Adbhuta Purva Sahasa Kshuchibhyam Arditatmana Brahmanam Pratyabhut Brahman Matsaro manyur evacha Adbhuta Purva. Unprecedented. Sahasa. Circumstantially. Kshut. Hunger. Tridbhyam. As well as by thirst, ardita, being distressed, atmanaha, of his self, brahmanam, unto a brahmana, prati, against, Adbhut became Brahman, O Brahmanas, Matsaraha, envious, Manyuhu, angry, Eva, thus, Cha, and translation. O Brahmanas, the king's anger and envy directed toward the Brahmana sage were unprecedented, being that circumstances had made him hungry and thirsty. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. For a king like Maharaj Parikshit to become angry and envious, especially at a sage and a brahmana, was undoubtedly unprecedented. The king knew well that brahmanas, sages, children, women, and old men are always beyond the jurisdiction of punishment. Similarly, the king, even though he commits a great mistake, is never to be considered a wrongdoer. But in this case, Maharaj Prakrit became angry and envious at the sage due to his thirst and hunger by the will of the Lord. The king was right to punish his subject for coldly receiving him or neglecting him, but because the culprit was a sage and a brahmana, it was unprecedented. As the Lord is never envious of anyone, so also the Lord's devotee is never envious of anyone. The only justification for Maharaj Prakrit's behavior is that it was ordained by the Lord. Adbhuta purva sahasa kshutribhyam arditat manaha brahmanam pratyadbhut brahman matsaro manyur evacha. O brahmanas, the king's anger and envy directed toward the Brahmin sage were unprecedented, being that circumstances had made him hungry and thirsty. So here we have a situation where a great devotee, a pure devotee, acts improperly on both a material level and a spiritual level. And the explanation which Srila Prabhupada repeatedly gives in this chapter, gives it over and over and over again, is that this behavior of Maharaj Prakrit, the behavior of Sringi, etc., was the will of the Lord. It was prompted by Krishna. And therefore, the person should not be blamed. It should not be considered a fall down. Although the persons involved didn't take it that way. They took it as their responsibility. So this brings up, of course, many questions. The number of questions and discussions from this one verse in purport, as we say, this will be repeated throughout the chapter, are so broad that it's very difficult to say, all right, what aspect of this are we going to look at? But I would say that we run into the situation where we ask the question, is what's happening the will of Krishna, or is it due to my own nonsense? Just like some children, I believe, or a child drowned in the Ganga when Prabhupada was with us, and the devotees went to Prabhupada and said, oh, it's Krishna's mercy, and Prabhupada says, no, it's your own foolishness. So this is often a question, is what's happening to me, is what I'm doing, is this being prompted by Krishna, or is it just my own nonsense? Or is it the nonsense of the other people? How should I respond to the behavior of other people? So let's look and see why this was wrong. So on the material level, this is what Maharaj Prakrit did. Maharaj Prakrit's anger and envy, matsarhas, that he was actually envious of the sage. That why are you having, because the sage had basically a position superior to the king. Only a superior can refuse to serve you or answer you when you talk to them. As someone who's inferior to you, they have to answer you or they have to follow your instructions. Just like in the Bible, there's the book of Esther. So Esther was the queen of King Ahasuerus. And she learned from her cousin, I believe, that her whole people were going to be killed, that there was going to be genocide. And her husband, the king, didn't realize that she was part of the group which he had targeted for genocide. So she wanted to try to stop the upcoming massacre. So what she did was she fasted and prayed for three days. And then she went into the king's room without him having called her. Now, the punishment for that could be up to death. You could get up to the death penalty for going into the king's chamber without him being called. Therefore, she had done penance previously to hope to gain a favorable outcome. Anyway, when she went into the chamber, it says he put out his scepter and he received her. And therefore, she was able to speak to him. My point is that in approaching a superior, the superior is not under any obligation to receive you, to speak to you, to deal with you. Of course, in modern society, especially in Western countries, we have tried as far as possible to dispense with this notion of superior and inferior we try to have this concept that everyone is equal. So these sort of things from the scriptures may not really resonate with us. They may not really make any sense to us. You know, we hear all the time children saying to their parents, well, how come you can punish me but I can't punish you, etc. But this was the standard, that somebody in a position of authority could refuse to speak to you. They could refuse to receive you. Now, the king has the concept that he's the head of society, that no one is superior to him. But of course, in a varnashram system, in a shastrically run system, the brahmanas are certainly superior to the king. And not only was Shamaka Rishi a brahmana, but he was a sage. Prabhupada makes this point. He was a sage and a brahmana. A sage means that he had attained perfection. As we read previously, he'd attained the Brahma-Bhuta platform of realization. He wasn't simply a brahmana by birth. He wasn't simply a brahmana by initiation, or even a brahmana just by occupation. You know, one can be a brahmana by occupation and by some situation in the mode of goodness and not really be a sage. We would not expect that in former ages that all of the brahmanas were actually sages. Of course, some sages were not brahmanas. That's another topic. But the Shamaka Rishi, he was both a realized Brahmabhuta sage and he was a brahmana. And so therefore he was above the king in terms of material social etiquette. So here Maharaj Parikshit was feeling envious, matsadaha, that oh, someone's above me. So he was, the way he was interpreting the situation, the way Maharaj Parikshit was interpreting the situation was, oh, this person is thinking that he's above me. How dare he be above me? So he became very angry and envious. I should be above everyone. So on a material level, this was improper because the king is never supposed to be in an envious or angry attitude towards a brahmana. And what to speak of a brahmana who's a sage. And nor is he supposed to be meting out punishment to certain groups of people. Here it says here, brahmanas, sages, children, women, and old men. So even in modern society, there's different kinds of punishment for children than for adults. I don't think they have it for old men or brahmanas and women. It used to be anyway that the laws were more lenient on women. I don't know if that's still true. It probably isn't. But I wouldn't be surprised if juries and judges are more lenient with women anyway, whether it's in the law or not. They're certainly not more lenient with brahmanas and sages and old men. But in other words, those are people who should be taken care of and protected. So the sage was in those categories of someone who the king was supposed to protect and not, and certainly not become envious of, just as an ordinary king. Then on another level, what Maharaj Parikshit did was wrong. So first of all, what he did was wrong from a social level, social political level, and from another point of view, it was wrong because, as Prabhupada says here, Krishna is never envious of anyone. And so Krishna's devotee is not expected to be envious of anyone. That the Lord wants the devotee to be in a superior position to him. And we see this to some extent in this world, especially with parents and children or teachers and student, parental type relationships. I believe we see this sort of thing most often, where the person in the parental relationship takes pleasure when their child or student excels them. They're not envious of their child or their student. So again, it's not seen often. We do see parents and teachers, probably more teachers than parents, who are indeed envious of their subordinate, and they want their, although they want their subordinate to do well, they don't want their subordinate to do as well as they do, what to speak of to excel them. But we do find this with parents. We do find even parents who are generally very envious, they may take pleasure if their child excels them or at least comes to the same level as them. And Krishna being the Supreme Father, aham bija pradapitaha, the Supreme Father, the Supreme Mother, has this mood to a very high degree. So Krishna has the mood that he enjoys having his devotees excel him. He enjoys having his devotees in a superior position. He actually takes pleasure in it. I mean, not only does he not mind, but he relishes it. And particularly is this true, of course, in Vrindavan. So Krishna, therefore, is not envious of anyone. He has no sense like that. You know, many times people think that this material world is designed as a punishment by God, by Krishna, for those who won't surrender to him. But that's not really true. I mean, on one level, you could say that that's true, but it's not Krishna's mood. His mood is not, oh, you want to be God? You want to be my competitor? Well, go and suffer, and the only way you're going to be happy is to be my subordinate. And that's not the mood of Krishna at all. If one wants to be Krishna's superior in a loving mood, then Krishna welcomes that. What Krishna doesn't like, what nobody would like, is somebody who wants to be a superior in an envious mood. You know, if this a father may desire that his son equal or excel him, but the father does not desire that the son put him in prison. Like the story of Shah Jahan, who built the Taj Mahal and his son imprisoned him. Or Kamsa, who imprisoned Ugrasena to take over the kingdom. So the father, who's the king, he wants the son to become king, but he doesn't want the son to become king by putting him in jail or by killing him. You know, the man running a big business empire, he doesn't want his son to excel him, his child to excel him, again, by having some sort of a coup. So the conditioned souls are souls who wanted to be superior to Krishna out of envy and out of malice. And therefore, they're causing a disturbance in the cosmic order. And they need to be removed from the reality. And one can also see that there, Krishna, out of his kindness and non-enviousness, is allowing the conditioned soul the illusion that they are the supreme. In fact, he's willing to give the conditioned soul the post even of Brahma, to be the supreme, so-called, in a universe. So Krishna is not envious, and the pure devotees who have attained at least Brahma-Bhuta, if not beyond, they have the same qualities of the Lord. They've realized their oneness and quality with the Lord, and therefore, the pure devotees are expected to be non-envious. In fact, many times in the Bhagavatam, the logical argument is given that the devotees are not envious, therefore how can Krishna be envious? That we see the great sages and the devotees are not envious or not materially attached. This argument is given, say, in regard to the Rasa-lila, that devotees are unattached from anything material. Therefore, Krishna's desires cannot be material. How can the master of those who are detached be attached? So often this argument is given in reverse, that because we see that those who are Brahma-Bhuta are non-envious, so the great Brahman must also be non-envious. So here Prabhupada is giving it the opposite way, that Krishna, as the Param Brahman, he's not envious. So therefore, how can a jiva who's realized his Brahman nature, his spiritual nature, be envious? So from two points of view, from a social position as the king, Maharaj Parikit, as a proper king, was not expected to behave in this way. He was expected to behave in a respectful way towards a brahmana and a sage. And from the point of view that Maharaj Parikit was also on the Brahma-Bhuta platform, he was expected not to be envious. So Maharaj Parikit is acting out of character. It's something, therefore, it's called adbhuta, astonishing. So this word astonishing is often used in a positive way. Tava karakamalavare nakam madbhuta shringam, that Nisingadev's nails are wonderfully sharp like peaks of mountains. But we'll say something is astonishing, we can mean that both positively or negatively. So here it's meant negatively. This is something not to be expected, something out of the ordinary, something unprecedented. So one could look at this and say, okay, well, if Maharaj Parikit is doing something that's both materially and spiritually unprecedented, it must be a kind of fall down for him. Maybe he really isn't that elevated. Someone asked me this just the other day. You know, if somebody who we think is elevated has a fall, does that mean they really weren't that elevated? Or can you fall from a position? So one conclusion one might reach from this pastime
is, well, maybe Maharaj Bhrigu wasn't that elevated. Maybe he wasn't that great of a king, even on a material level. That he couldn't control his mind and his senses. Or maybe he really wasn't self-realized. Maybe this pastime, this activity, this story, is evidence that he wasn't what he appeared to be. One might think like that. Or one might think, well, maybe he was that elevated, and perhaps he had some sort of temporary glitch. Maybe there was some blip, and then he had to be reinstated to his position. So Srila Prabhupada is repeating in this chapter, as I said earlier, that the explanation is that it was the Lord's will, that Krishna was instigating what would normally be very negative, unspiritual, unsocial, improper feelings and behavior. You know, the feelings come before the behavior. One's thoughts, how dare this sage act as if he's superior to me? And then the feelings of envy, they come before the behavior of, you know, putting the dead snake on the sage's neck and so forth. So it's interesting that Maharaj Parikit does not respond to his behavior by saying that his behavior was instigated by Krishna. That's not how he interprets the situation. He interprets the situation as a fall down and as an offense. As does Sringi later on, and as does Shamakarishi in relationship to Sringi. Now, it's interesting that Shamakarishi does not blame Maharaj Parikit. He does not say, oh, Maharaj Parikit has a fall down, or Maharaj Parikit wasn't really a bona fide king. And in fact, interestingly enough, here in this purport, and it's said also later in connection with this story, Prabhupada says the king is also not to be criticized, even if he commits a great mistake, which we used to think like that all over the world, but we certainly don't think like that anymore about our political leaders. If our political leaders in Western countries make even a small mistake, there we try to depose them. Anyway, Shamakarishi, perhaps from the point of view of materially, that one should not criticize, that the king can do no wrong, that the king is above the law, etc., etc. Although sometimes, that's not an absolute statement, because just like the Brahmanas dethroned Vena, so sometimes things would get so out of hand that the king is considered to be punishable or to be worthy of being taken down. But generally, that's not the case. So from material level, Shamakarishi later took it that, okay, I'm not supposed to blame the king. He's a good king. And if he makes some mistake one time, that should be forgiven. That should be overlooked. Of course, that's a general mood also of the Brahmanas. And as well, Shamakarishi took it that this was the will of the Lord, that Maharaj Parikit is a great devotee, and that whatever's happening is the will of the Lord. He should not have been punished. He should be forgiven for his anger and envy and snake garlanding, and he should not be punished. And similarly, Maharaj Parikit was not angry at Sringi. Maharaj Parikit didn't take any action or retaliate against Sringi or against Shamakarishi later on, but he said, oh, this is the will of the Lord that they have punished me, etc. So we see that the wronged parties took the situation as the will of God, and the wronging parties took their behavior as their own nonsense. They took their behavior as a fall down. They took their behavior as something that was sinful. So Sringi repented, Shamakarishi repented, and Maharaj Parikit repented. And Maharaj Parikit says later on, he says, let the reaction come on me immediately. You know, if you pay your debt immediately, there's not so much interest. Chanaka Pandit says, fire, debt, and disease should be taken care of very quickly. And the other thing, Maharaj Parikit didn't want anyone else to suffer. It seems that the law of karma is that when you do good, or when you do bad, it may affect those around you. I mean, we see that even in a very immediate sense. that if I do sinful things, the people who live with me and the people who care about me may also be affected. And if I do pious things, those same people may also be affected. So Maharaj Prickett was saying, don't let this reaction harm my family members. Let it come to me, and let it come to me swiftly. I'm not going to try to counteract this. What I did was wrong. So quite interesting. The person who does the wrong thing blames themselves, and the person who receives the wrong thing attributes what happened to divine intervention. So certainly when we do something wrong, we should not blame the other person's karma or the will of God. One can ask also, we just step back for a minute before I go into that. We can just think also, why does Krishna do things like this? Now, Krishna has his overall purposes to accomplish. He has his plan, and Krishna's plan takes place regardless of how the living entities behave. I think of it like a river flowing down to the ocean, that the river is going to get to the ocean. If there's rocks in the way, it will go over them, under them, around them. If there's a big drop, it becomes a waterfall. There's not really, you know, much of an obstacle that can stop the water. I mean, I suppose we can build huge dams to stop the water, but there's no jiva that can build a dam to stop the will of God. And that Krishna is very expert, that he can take all of our free will and weave it into his plan, that he can accommodate our free will. He doesn't need to override our free will for his plans to be effective. Now, we as jivas aren't that powerful with other jivas. So if I have a plan that I want to execute, and I'm dependent very often on other jivas to cooperate with that plan. And a lot of our behavior in this world is trying to force or manipulate or whatever, to induce other jivas to cooperate with my plan, because I'm helpless generally to accomplish my plans without the cooperation of other living entities. It's very rare in my own experience that I can accomplish a plan independently of every single other living entity in creation. In fact, I can't think of any instance where that's the case. I'm dependent on other living entities to be in cooperation, other humans, the demigods, even the lower creatures. And so a lot of conditioned souls' energy is put into trying to convince or force or in some way induce other living entities to cooperate with their desire. And of course, because the conditioned souls have desires that are not in harmony with Krishna's plan or in harmony with each other, there's a lot of conflict and ill feeling. You know, if only you would cooperate with me, then everything would be nice, as if all my plans would be nice. Anyway, Krishna's not in this position. Krishna's in the position that he can allow every jiva to do whatever they want to do, according to their karma, of course, according to what they deserve, and at the same time accomplish his plans. He's not dependent on my decisions or your decisions or anyone else's decisions in order for things to go the way he wants them to go, nor does he need to force me or force anyone else in order to accomplish that. So how he does that is beyond clever. Now, in the case of Krishna's pure devotees who are in harmony with his will, then their free will is in cooperation with Krishna's plan. That doesn't mean that they have no free will, that they're just like robots, but just like Prabhupada compares it to a harmonious family where people work together, or a harmonious business operation where, you know, sometimes we work as a team, and there's a team leader, and we work in harmony, and we've all had this sort of experience. How pleasant it is when, although we're individual souls with individual desires and individual points of view, we choose to work in harmony. We're in a situation where we feel that we're compatible, and we're working as a team. It's quite a satisfying experience. So this is the way that the pure devotees work with Krishna. And sometimes Krishna asks the pure devotees to work in harmony with his plan by doing things which, from an ordinary perspective, would appear to be bad examples, just like Yudhisthira gambling in the gambling match. You know, or when the five Pandavas decided to all marry Draupadi. And one of Maharaj Yudhisthira's arguments for doing this is he said, this is my desire, and I never have a sinful desire. I know that anything that I desire is pious and is in harmony with Krishna, which I thought was an extraordinary argument, that whatever I think, anything that comes to my mind must be right. And because this has come to my mind, therefore, it is the right thing to do. I don't think most of us could say that about our minds. Or Bhishma fighting on the side of the Kurus, Drona fighting on the side of the Kurus. So the devotees are willing to play any role in the Lord's leelas. You know, many times in a drama, people want to get the leading role. They don't want to play a small part, or they don't want to play the bad guys. But the devotees are willing to take any role. They're even willing to play the bad guys. Or they're willing to play a part where they do something wrong. Now, that has to be there also for the story to unfold and for lessons to be learned. Like Prabhupada quotes that the mother-in-law teaches her daughter-in-law through teaching her daughter. Now, that means two things. That first of all, if every mother teaches her daughter properly, then all daughters-in-law will also behave properly. But it also means that her daughter's in the house, and her daughter-in-law's in the house, and when she instructs, instead of instructing her daughter-in-law, who might not take it very well, she instructs her daughter, and her daughter-in-law hears that and follows. So sometimes the devotees show what not to do. You might say, well, why is that necessary? So many non-devotees are already giving an example of what not to do. You know, why can't that be sufficient? Because it's very important to say, even if you're a great devotee, don't ever think that you can do this. There'll be a reaction. You may be as great as Yudhisthira, but if you gamble, then you're going to suffer. You may be as great as Maharaj Bricket, but if you become envious, and if you become offensive, then you will suffer. So that's the message. Of course, there's many other things going on in this story besides that. That's not the only thing that's going on. We could also say that, as Prabhupada also explains in the Bhagavatam, that Maharaj Bricket had become somewhat attached to his situation. We talked about this the other day. And that Krishna wanted to remove him. Krishna wanted to free him from this attachment. So how to free him? What would be the means? As a responsible king, Maharaj Bricket was not going to leave his kingdom until it was the ripe time, until he had a proper heir and he was old enough to retire. So he was going to be responsible. Therefore, on his own volition, Maharaj Bricket would not give up the service he was doing for Krishna, even though Krishna at this point wanted him to give it up, wanted him to go to another position. So how was he going to give it up? And who outside of himself had the power to force him to give it up? He was not going to do so willingly. And who could force him? The only person who could force him was a brahmana. But what brahmana would force him to leave his position? Maharaj Bricket had walled off the age of Kali. And therefore, there would not be any brahmana who would dare to curse Maharaj Bricket. So the only way, because only a brahmana would have the power to get Bricket out of his position. And no brahmana would have any reason to do that. So therefore, Krishna arranged that a reason was created by inducing Parikshit to basically commit an offense. So that's also part of what's happening here. Right, like in the story of the Brahmana children that were stolen from Dwarka by Mahavishnu. And I believe it's Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur who comments that Mahavishnu so much wanted to see his own form of Krishna that he figured, if I give trouble to a Brahmana, then Krishna will respond. He's not going to go without protecting the Brahmanas. Of course, Krishna didn't respond simply to the harassment of a Brahmana. He only responded when Arjuna was in danger. But Krishna, my point is that Krishna may sometimes take those sort of measures in order to accomplish what he wants, as well as Maharaj Parikit was setting an example again of what not to do. No matter how powerful you are, you cannot do that. So for ourselves, we also have our general character. We have our general way of behaving. We have our way of behaving according to proper etiquette and rules. And we also have our general state of consciousness, our general way of seeing things. And sometimes we may do something that's out of character, just like Maharaj Parikit did here. He did something that was out of character, as we said in the beginning, from both the spiritual and a material perspective. So when we do something that's out of character, we find that these great devotees, again, they never say, oh, Krishna induced me to do that. They never think like that. Even if it's true, they don't think like that. They take personal responsibility and they repent and they try to rectify. So whenever we do anything that's out of character, whenever we do anything that's beneath us, we should try to rectify, but without hatred. Now, one devotee was talking to me and she was really having a hard time. And she said, oh, you know, Urmila, I hate it when I act like this. I end up hating myself and I hate hating myself. I feel so embarrassed at how I'm acting. So we're not meant to hate ourselves, but we are certainly meant to be repentant. We are meant to feel some shame. There's some psychological research that joy is impossible for people who never feel any shame, which is interesting since shame is probably the most painful material emotion that one can experience. But without the capacity to feel some shame, joy is inaccessible according to modern psychology. Prabhupada often criticizes people as being shameless, people who do something wrong openly, publicly, without any sense of shame for what they're doing. So a sense of shame, a sense of repentance. And Prabhupada says, in regard to the story of Maharaj Parikit, that a devotee's sinful activities are burned up in the fire of repentance. So to have some sense that I've done something wrong, I've offended my Lord, I've displeased my Lord, and I need to do something to rectify this. To admit to ourselves and to Krishna, we don't have to make a public pronouncement to the universe, but certainly to Krishna. I was actually just hearing Prabhupada say that yesterday, how one should confess to Krishna, this is what I've done wrong. Because in one sense, the only person we can really offend is Krishna. So to admit to Krishna, of course, if our offense has been to a specific living entity, then we also need to admit to that living entity and repent to that living entity. We have to try to fix what we've done. And we should be willing to take the punishment. Tateinu kampansu shimikshamanam. So the emphasis is that just having this attitude that I am an offender and I need to fix this and whatever reaction I'm getting is due me, just this attitude, Dayabak, one inherits the kingdom of God. That should tell us that having that attitude is not an easy or cheap thing to do. And the other day, one of my grandchildren was speaking in a very disrespectful way, not behaving properly. And I kept saying to him, you know, there's going to be some consequence for your behavior. And finally, I just took his computer away for a while. So it was quite interesting and quite typical that after I took his computer away, he immediately changed his behavior and he apologized. But his motive was to get his computer back. His motive was not to understand what he did wrong and to fix it and to actually be repentant and to realize what kind of a disturbance he had done. Of course, he did eventually do that. But I could see very clearly, you know, he started to behave differently and say, I'm really sorry for what I did wrong. And they said, okay, can I have my computer back now? And I thought, wow, you know, his motives are so transparent. So we often deal with Krishna like that. You know, we're suffering in some way. I think all of us are suffering in some way. We're suffering with our body, or we're suffering with our mind, or we're suffering with the other people we have to deal with on a regular basis, or we're suffering from some circumstance of nature. And we go to Krishna and we say, can I have my computer back? You know, can you take the punishment away, please? Oh, I'll be good. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you take the punishment away? But the mood of one who enters the kingdom of God, and the mood we want to see with people who do something wrong to us, is that the person wants to fix it, not to get rid of the punishment, but so the person wants to fix it because they actually care about the relationship, because they actually care about us, not because, not that they're just simply trying to manipulate us into giving them a happy life while they don't care about us. So generally, when we want to be relieved from our suffering and given a nice situation, we don't really care about rectifying our mentality and pleasing Krishna. So that is the view of the devotee. When we do something out of character, the view of the devotee is, this is my fault, this is my responsibility, I want to rectify it, and I am willing to get whatever reaction is coming because of my behavior. I don't want to rectify things to avoid the reaction. I want to rectify things to please Krishna. And if Krishna wants me to still get the reaction, fine. If Krishna wants to take away the reaction, fine. That's his business. You know, my grandson was also asking me over and over again, so when are you going to give my computer back? When are you going to... He must have asked me, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 times. So, but the view of Tatten, you come from Sukshamikshama, no, is Krishna, whenever you want to, that's up to you. You decide when you're going to remove this punishment, and I still want to rectify myself, just because I want to reestablish my relationship with you. So that was Maharaj Bricket's attitude towards what he did. And he never said, well, it's Krishna's will. He never said, although it was Krishna's will, he never said, oh, this is just your karma. He didn't take that view. So at the same time, the devotee does see Krishna's hand. So Maharaj Bricket, although he never shifted the responsibility or blame to God, he never said, oh, okay, it's not my fault. After all, I'm a pure devotee. Whatever I do is the will of God. He never said that. Still, he saw the will of God in what happened, in the sense that he saw the reaction that came. Because the reaction Maharaj Bricket got was not commensurate with his behavior. Putting a dead snake around the sage's neck was not worthy of the death penalty. And he saw it as the will of God. He saw that Krishna had taken the form of this curse. So the devotee in all circumstances sees that Krishna is involved. Now I get asked this so many times, is what's happening to me Krishna's will or my nonsense? My answer is both. If you're a conditioned soul, then to some extent what's happening is due to our nonsense. Because that's what a conditioned soul means. A conditioned soul means there's some degree of nonsense. I find it quite humorous when people will admit in one breath that they're not at the level of prema, and then in the other breath think that they don't do anything wrong. It just doesn't make any sense. Sorry, Naishvishnath Chakravarti Thakur, in his purport in the 10th canto in regard to the gopis who were kept back from Ras Lila, he discusses how if a devotee takes as sense objects things in relation to Krishna, if a devotee enjoys hearing about Krishna, eating Krishna prasadam, then to that extent the devotee's body is actually spiritualized. And if the devotee takes as sense objects material things, to that extent their body and mind are material. So a devotee can have a body and mind that's part spiritual and part material. That's what we mean by gradual process. So the devotee's mood is, yes, I still have some aspects of myself that are material, therefore I may do something wrong. But everything that happens to everyone is the will of the Lord. What to speak of everything that happens to the devotee who's one time surrendered himself to the Lord? everything that happens to such a person is directly the personal will of the Lord. Even if my behavior was nonsense. Again, let's go back to my grandson. So his situation where he lost his computer was the will of the grandmother. It was in relationship to something nonsense he did, but it was still the will of his superior. So the will of Krishna is there, whether you're a conditioned soul or a liberated soul. There's no question of it not being the will of Krishna. Now, one could say, well, okay, but if I didn't do anything wrong, would Krishna's will have manifested differently? Okay, perhaps. How can we say? We can never say what would have happened. But we can say that for a devotee, for one who surrendered, even for the conditioned souls in a larger sense, but certainly for the surrendered souls, however Krishna's will manifests is for the benefit of that person. So I didn't take my grandson's computer away out of malice or to harm him. I took it away from him to try to help him. Now, would I have tried to help him in a different way had his actions been different? Probably. But still my behavior was there for his benefit. And I'm just a very ordinary person. So what to speak of Krishna? His reciprocation in dealings with his devotees is always for their benefit. Always. Now, what precipitates his particular response, in one sense, is not terribly important. Just the fact that it's my nonsense that precipitates a particular response doesn't mean that that response is any less loving or any less appropriate for me or any less the will of Krishna than if his response was precipitated by something devotional. And then how I respond to Krishna's dealing with me takes me to the next level. So if I do something wrong and Krishna responds in a way that I find materially uncomfortable, my response to that materially uncomfortable situation is then takes me to the next place. It takes me to my next reciprocal dealings with Krishna. So if I'm in a difficult situation and I respond by being angry and resentful and asking for the difficult situation to be removed and so forth and so on, you know, then I'm continuing to act wrongly and the way Krishna reciprocates with me will probably be less desirable. And if I respond to Krishna's loving reciprocations that are apparently negative by saying, well, this is my just reaction to my own nonsense and let me remember Krishna in this difficult situation, then Krishna will be very pleased. And his next responses to me will be ones that will be more pleasing. Now, we can also very briefly talk about, because time is short, how we see others' actions. Do we see others' actions against us as the will of the Lord, or do we see other actions against us as their nonsense? And here again, we have the situation where Shamukha Rishi did not criticize Maharaj Prakrit. He did not say, oh, just see, Maharaj Prakrit is not what I thought he was. He's not really a great devotee. He's not really a great king. Just look at his behavior. He became envious. He must be really fallen. Throw him out. Dethrone him. He didn't say that. You know, and Maharaj Prakrit didn't say that about Sringi. He didn't say, oh, this wretched Brahma Bandhu, he's not a qualified Brahmana, take him out of his position, let's counteract the curse and remove him. But each party in this, later on, they took what happened against them as the will of the Lord. So they took what they did as something wrong that needed rectification, and they took what was done to them as the will of the Lord. And one might say, well, that's not very fair. But that's how one comes to peace and happiness. So we can be stuck in some, our own distorted concept of fairness and suffer, or we can be absorbed in the transcendental vision and be happy and peaceful. So again, there were many other things we could have talked about in this verse and purport. And because this particular point comes up many, many, many times in this pastime, this is a deep concept, but there will be ample opportunities to explore it as we go through this chapter in more depth and from, as Prabhupada says, many angles of vision. So questions, comments, etc.
Great class. I always appreciate your insights, and there's a lot to understand here. But here's something. I'm just going to kind of toss this out. Not make everybody the most comfortable, but we all understand English is a living language, and that the meanings of words change over time according to usage. And of course, as preachers, we're communicators in the current understanding of the language. So I think you did a great job explaining how Prabhupada expressed how Maharaj Parikkhit was being envious of the superior and how that works. But during your class, I checked both the Oxford and American dictionaries for their definitions, and my understanding growing up kind of concurs with those definitions, that envy is more or less synonymous with jealousy, the usage. So I never felt comfortable with this envy. I accept that you've explained it rather well in details how that works. But if I were telling this pastime to someone, I might choose to explain that due to Maharaj Parikkhit's extreme hunger and thirst, of course arranged by the Lord, that he acted out of anger, that he was frustrated that the sage was not attending to his extreme need for water, a basic need to preserve his body. So, and at the middle of it all is he questioned whether the sage was really in trance or not, suspecting that he was pretending, you know, to be in trance to avoid his duty to serve the emperor, which means that he's in the superior position to the Brahmin. But, you know, how perfect was the arrangement of that dead cobra nearby his hut so he could test the samadhi of Samika Rishi? And as you pointed out in your class, I'm sure Maharaj Parikkhit regretted his offense to the yogi, and you know, who did not deserve to be disrespected. He passed the test. He didn't flinch when the snake was thrown on his neck. But I've also read somewhere that Maharaj Parikkhit felt remorse for this incident, and that he was somewhat relieved when he heard he'd been cursed, so that he could be purified from the reaction of disrespecting a great yogi. So, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, but I feel more comfortable with, Maharaj Parikkhit acted inappropriately, but I don't feel comfortable with the word envy, even after the class.
Problem is, it's in the verse. Matsaraha.
Whoa.
It's in the verse.
Okay.
It's in the verse. I wouldn't have said such a thing had it not been the Sanskrit word of the verse. Matsaro manyur evacha. So manyu is anger, and matsara is envy. Now, I didn't talk about hunger and thirst, although that was also mentioned here in the Sanskrit shutribhyam, which was also astonishing, because someone on the Brahmabhuta platform is not affected by hunger and thirst. It doesn't affect them psychologically. So that's another reason, you know, which wasn't mentioned in this purport, which is why I didn't emphasize it, but it's mentioned in other purports. So three reasons it was astonishing. One reason it was astonishing is from a social point of view, a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, would not treat a sage like this. Another reason it was astonishing is, as Prabhupada says in this purport, as the Lord is never envious of anyone, so also the Lord's devotee is never envious of anyone. The envy of Parikkhit was astonishing. And the other reason it was astonishing was that hunger and thirst could induce him to anger and envy. Because normally a person on the Brahmabhuta platform, as Maharaj Parikkhit is not affected. They're aware that their body is hungry and thirsty, but it doesn't affect them psychologically. And we see this a little later on when Maharaj Parikshit fasts for 7 days by the Ganga. So for 7 days by the Ganga, he's not eating, sleeping, or drinking. And it doesn't affect his behavior and his consciousness. But anyway, I talked about the word envy because it's right here in the Sanskrit. And envy is a very heavy word. It's much a heavier word than anger. And I felt that I could either ignore it or I could decide to address it and look at, you know, in what sense, in what way, in what sense could we understand that the anger, the actions of Parikshit could be classified as envy.
So Sanskrit is just for balance. You know, it's a much more sophisticated language than English. So there's so many words, shades of meaning in different ways.
Definitely. But Matsaraha is the word most commonly used for envy. And again, Prabhupada picks this up in the purport. Let's see how many times. 3 times. For a king like in the purport, he says, if it's in the translation, the king's anger and envy. In the purport, Prabhupada says, for a king like Maharaj Parikshit to become angry and envious. Later on, he says, in this case, Maharaj Parikshit became angry and envious. And then the last sentence, again, he talks about, as the Lord is never envious, so also the Lord's devotee is never envious. So Prabhupada uses the word envious altogether 4 times, 3 points of envy, plus it's in the translation, plus it's in the Sanskrit. So again, I saw the concept of envy being, you know, how dare this subject of mine act in a superior position to me.
Right. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I like it.
Okay. Glad you like it. I mean, that's what Prabhupada says here also. The king was right to punish his subject for coldly receiving him, but because the subject was a sage and a brahmana. So under normal conditions, if it wasn't a sage and a brahmana, under any other conditions, it would not be, you know, it would be actually proper. Because the subject would be taking a role of a superior improperly. But in this case, a brahmana and a sage actually is a superior. And we have a lot of difficulty coming up in the scripture where kshatriyas sometimes don't respect brahmanas, where they're, you know, become envious of the brahmanas, and that brahmana whose babies were stolen in Dwarka makes this point. He says a king who is only envious of the brahmanas, because look, somebody who's a king, he has Ishwar above, which Prabhupada translates at least in one place as the mentality of wanting to protect others. But it could also be understood as the mentality of wanting to be in control and wanting to be the, what do we say here, the head kahuna, you know, the big cheese. And the kshatriyas, in order to be a kshatriya, you've got to be subordinate to the brahmanas. I'm sure they don't like it sometimes. Just like Vishvamitra, he became envious of the power of Vasistha and tried to kill him. And eventually, Vishvamitra decided to become a brahmana out of envy. He thought, well, if I become a brahmana, then I'll be as powerful or more powerful than Vasistha. Now, of course, the process of becoming a brahmana eventually cured him of his envy. Just like with bhakti yoga, that even if you originally take up bhakti out of anger, envy, or lust, or whatever, the process of bhakti eventually cures you of that initial motive. But I'll tell you frankly, I've spoken on this lila many times, and this is the first time ever that I decided to go head on with the fact that the Bhagavatam and the purport says that Parikshit was envy, uses this word matsara. I've chosen to avoid it in every other case, and this time I took a risk and decided to hit it.
Right, you turned it beautifully on this one phrase you just came back with. How dare this yogi act in this way? That nailed it.
Mm. Yeah, I really like what you said. I had never thought of that before, that putting the dead snake on his neck was a kind of test.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it's true, Maharaj Parikshit wasn't sure whether or not the yogi was in a trance. See, the thing is, even if the yogi wasn't in a trance, the yogi actually was in a superior position. And he really did have, I mean, socially, perhaps not spiritually, but socially, he was in a superior position. And he did have the right to refuse the king's order, which was given in a very commanding tone, as explained in the Shastra. But certainly if he's in a trance. So I like that putting the dead snake was not just a kind of retribution. Prabhupada calls it tit for tat, but it was also a sort of test. Well, is he in a trance, in which case it would be excused? Or is he not in a trance and he's just being insubordinate, which is an interesting term in language. You know, subordinate. Ordinate is counting sub as beneath, insubordinate, not counting himself beneath me. And, of course, the sages were happy to serve the king. A real sage and a real brahmana is not going to have the mood that, oh, I'm superior to the king. The real sage and the real brahmana would honor the king, to speak of a Raja Rishi like Parikit. And they were both on the Brahma-Bhuta platform. So the brahmana wouldn't have had any kind of a pride like that in his position. But thank you for bringing up these points and churning this. I really appreciate it.
You know, I heard a story where the Krishna Balaramandir, this man came up during Prabhupada's class. He fainted in front of Krishna Balaram. I don't know if this is a true story. This is a dangerous story to tell. I mean, I heard it from a devotee. Maybe it was supposed to be there or something. Anyway, he tells a story that Prabhupada said, go over and kick him in the head.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that
really
also.
Really out. He's not going to feel it. And if he isn't out, he's going to get up and leave.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any questions or comments?
Actually, I heard it wasn't kicking the head. It was take him outside, dump him outside, which they did. And then he got up and spoke to Bibi. So the devotee said, oh, I guess Prabhupada knows what he's talking about.
Okay, good.
Mother Irma, is there a way to summarize your explanation, which is fascinating, how we can tell, decipher whether we're doing something, or we did something foolish, or it was Krishna's arrangement? You gave the example of the person where a child drowned in the Ganga, and they said this is Krishna's mercy, Prabhupada said it was your foolishness. Maybe I just have to go back and listen to your class again, because you made so many points. But at this point, it's a little confused in my mind that there's so many points were there. Is there a way to summarize, or maybe it's just too complex to summarize it, how we can tell? It's really important. It's an important principle for all of us to embrace when we're doing something, and we just did something foolish, it was Krishna's arrangement.
I don't know. I think the safe road is if I do something that causes some harm to myself or others, my default value is it's due to my foolishness. And then I'm safe. You know, so if I make any decision that because of that decision that I make, or because of omission or commission, that I'm harmed or other people are harmed, I'm going to take responsibility. And I can say that as a default value because I can see that although I want to be a devotee of Krishna and I'm at least externally following the process that Srila Prabhupada gave us, thank you Krishna for taking care of me, that my heart is very contaminated. And I'm not just saying this out of some stupid social humility. You know, it is. And the more that I chant and the more that I follow, the more I see that my motives are rotten. You know, what I see, materialistic people think that they have good motives, but they sometimes have wrong behavior just due to circumstances. Well, my motives are good and my behavior is sometimes wrong. And what's really awful is when people think that of themselves and then they assume other people's motives are bad. So other people, when other people do something wrong, it's because they have bad motives. When I do something wrong, I have good motives, but I just, you know, made some sort of mistake. I didn't understand things clearly or whatever. It's quite an interesting phenomena that that's how most conditioned souls think. However, the devotee thinks, if I've done something wrong, it's because I have bad motives. And if we are at all anything less than prema, then there's a good chance that that's true. So why not think that way? That's safer. That doesn't mean you hate yourself. Just figure that if I've done something that's caused pain to others, it's because my motives are off. Let me try to fix that. Well, let me try to rectify. That's safest to me. Otherwise, you know, we have a cheating propensity, and we are so have such a tendency to cheat ourselves. But I don't know. Maybe somebody else has more insight into that than I do.
Can I say something about the story about the guy getting kicked in the head? Because that actually, you know, what happened, what I understand, was that a guy fainted years ago in San Francisco. And, you know, and then Prabhupada said, oh, you should have kicked him in the head. And no one actually kicked him in the head. Years later, Hari Shari, having heard that story, actually kicked the guy in the head and threw him out of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And it caused a huge scandal because here's this white, jacked up Australian guy throwing this local guy out of the temple. And Prabhupada actually had that guy, because it was such a big thing all over Vrindavan, that guy had to be brought to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada personally apologized and brought Hari Shari in, because he took it literally and kicked the guy in the head and threw him out of his Krishna Balaram room there. So I think Hari Shari will readily admit it. He might have written about it directly. Just to clarify this for...
Okay.
Yeah, it's in his biography. Yeah, he's very regretful for what he had done.
Yeah, so he had heard about it. No one was ever actually kicked in the head originally, but he decided he took it literally, having heard about it. But Prabhupada meant it, of course, in jest. Prabhupada said so many things, like he told Balavanta, yeah, so if we take over, when Balavanta was running for something in Atlanta, he said, yes, if we take charge, then we tell them Hare Krishna or boom, and he pretended to shoot people. But it was a joke. I mean, you know, someone could take that literally, but because people are just naive, you know, have a sense of humor that, you know. And so, you know, the guru is a little more intelligent than us, luckily.
Hmm.
Well, Prabhupada said, like, we could shoot him. We'll, you know, when we take over, we're going to start shooting people. Like, you know, okay. Right. Kick him in the head, throw him out, knock him down, drag him out.
Right. That was not the way Prabhupada dealt with anybody.
Yeah. And somebody quoted the other day, Nadate Kasitit Papam Nachaiva Sukhatam Vibho, the third chapter Gita verse, in reference to Krishna saying, I don't take anyone's sinful activity, or, and they used it nicely. I hadn't heard it used in a long time, but it seemed to be apropos to, you know, trying to get Krishna to blame for anything. You know that verse?
Yeah.
I don't assume the sinful reaction or the... Exactly, I forget in English. Nadate kasitit papam nachaiva sukritam vibho. Nor the good... Krishna's independent of any of that. It seems to be a nice verse to invoke in certain arguments like this, certain times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't blame Krishna for what happens.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anybody else?
No, I was also going to say, I thought it was a wonderful class.
I have a question.
I also was a little bit bewildered by the word envy. I'm glad Vidya Madhava brought it up. But I thought you masterfully explained the word.
So I have a question. When we are in the position of authority...
Well, I'm thinking about words. Sometimes the envy is used humans then think it's similar to a synonym to jealousy, that there are many different meanings separate.
Yes.
You know, I think we should actually consider more what that meaning of envy is, you know, all the different, and what it really means, because we use it a lot.
Yeah, actually, Damayanti, I'm glad you brought that up. I remember Ravindra Sarup specifically talking about this word that in India, envy is me is used as jealousy. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, what it means and where it's being spoken by Prabhupada and what it means in the Sanskrit meaning of the word. What's the word for jealousy? For instance, in Sanskrit, it's not the same as Maya. And what Prabhupada is actually meaning, basically, we need to look into that more, all the different terms he uses it, and
right.
Not just assume that it means jealousy as we understand it in our dictionaries.
I looked up both meanings in the Oxford Dictionary because Prabhupada was trained, you know, in that English. The only word that I could come up with which kind of works is begrudge. You begrudge the sage. The rest of it is pretty much sounds like jealousy.
Well, in some languages, there's only one word. I don't know. Yugalaras, is that true in Russian? Because I remember being in Russia, and one devotee had put a presentation together where a large part of it was looking at the difference between envy and jealousy, and the Russian translator said, we don't have two words in Russian for that.
That's right, yes. It's no two words for that.
It's just one word. So it was interesting, because this presenter had really, literally, 15 minutes of her presentation was just based on that concept, and it took her about 5 minutes to accept the fact that she was going to have to throw out that part of her presentation in Russia, because that whole idea didn't exist. On a very side note, we could bring up the point that sociologists conjecture that people's language also has a big effect on their perceptions of the world. So a language where there's only one word for both envy and jealousy versus a language where there's two words, envy and jealousy, is going to change how you interpret what's happening. Now, that's a conjecture. They're not been able to prove that. Of course, it's very difficult to prove anything when it comes to human behavior. You can simply say we have strong evidence for it. But there is also evidence that people who know more than one language are capable of nuances of thought that monolingual people don't have, that people who are bi or trilingual have a better capacity of seeing things from different angles of vision in different ways, because there are certain concepts that are simply not translatable, that every language has particular concepts or words that only exist in that language, or that, you know, it can't be translated into any other language. So we do run into a problem, and I find this word envy in English is a very strong word. Jealousy in English, most people, the connotation of jealousy is much lighter, and most people will be more likely to admit that they're experiencing jealousy than that they're experiencing envy. Envy as a strong connotation of heavy evil. And this verse which is saying that Parikshit was both envious and angry, and I thought it very significant, Vidagdha Madhava Prabhu, that you had no trouble saying that, well, we could explain to someone that he was angry. That wasn't a problem. But to say, to go to a general audience and say that he was envious, although that's the word used in the Sanskrit here, that we'd be hesitant to do that because it smacks so much of evil. And Srila Prabhupada talks about that our original cause of our conditioning is our envy of Krishna. And I see that this envy of Krishna is very much tied in with not just anger, but deep anger, which we would call even hatred or fury. All right, I think we should end here. Thank you.